Okay, then welcome everyone to Wednesday session in Second Life. Today I've changed the time talking with Dalani. This seems like a more appropriate time. And I'd like to thank you all for coming. It's good to see new faces. It's also good to see old faces. It's good to see that we're able to keep together as a community. And even though the medium is an artificial medium, that we're able to maintain a relationship with our group, and that as a group we're able to come together and maintain and protect the Buddha's teaching, protect Buddhism, keep it going, keep it running, keep it progressing, and to help each other to develop. What I wanted to talk about today was the nature of Buddhism as a scientific inquiry. Because in a way you can look at our community, our group, as a community of scientists, if you will. Because in Buddhism the most important attainment, the most important goal, the ultimate aim of our practice is wisdom. This is what Buddhism means. Buddha means one who knows, or it means one who has awakened to the truth. Bodhi means wisdom or realization, knowledge. And this is what science means. Science is the pursuit of knowledge. And so, well, it's important to qualify that by saying that unlike modern scientific endeavors, we're not out to know indiscriminately in the sense of wanting to know everything or putting the importance on the quality of knowing as opposed to discriminating between knowledges. You see, because in science, in modern science, it's not important the quality or the applicability necessarily of the knowledge. The important thing is knowledge. And the idea, the goal of science is to know everything or to expand our knowledge. Those things that are not yet known, to know them. In Buddhism, we limit this, of course, because there are many types of knowledge that are not beneficial and not useful for our purpose. So when we talk about the Buddha as being one who knows, our qualification is that the qualifier is that the Buddha is one who knows that which is important to know, or is one who has gained the highest knowledge. Now, of course, they say the Buddha knew everything, or the Buddha was able to find an answer to anything. That if simply by thinking about something he could get the answer. If he was asked a question, he could come up with the answer instantly. So the idea is that he did have omniscience in a sense. This is the belief or the tradition that we follow. But that's not what made him Buddha. That's not the most important thing. The important knowledge that the Buddha gained that gave him the name Buddha, and which actually gives all of us the name Buddha when we become enlightened, even following after his teaching, is that we come to know the Four Noble Truths. We come to know these things that these truths that are noble, that are important, that free us from all suffering. Because that's what is meant by the word useful. Those things that are useful in terms of developing society, or useful for maintaining physical health, or useful for providing entertainment and so on. Useful in a conventional sense. This isn't what is meant by the word useful. Useful is something that frees you from suffering. That in an ultimate sense brings you to peace, happiness, and freedom. So in that sense, we're scientists, because we're striving to gain this knowledge. And I think this is important to talk about and to emphasize, because the tendency in religion, when we talk about Buddhism as a religion, I think personally Buddhism is a religion, and we can have arguments and debates about that, but that also revolves around the meaning of the word religion, and we can get into that later. But the problem with calling something a religion generally is that it tends to lead people to develop beliefs, to develop faith, and to develop inexact understandings or beliefs or views or opinions that are not based on direct scientific inquiry and realization. So we have, oftentimes Buddhists will believe in things like rebirth or karma. They believe in the Buddha's enlightenment. Many people believe that there are bodhisattvas and Buddhas still here, and that if we pray to them, if we align ourselves with their nature, then we can somehow they will help us. This is a belief that we hold on to, a tradition that we hold on to, that there will be external guidance and external aid. A belief that certain practices will bring more benefit than other practices. The belief that rituals have some sort of inherent value in them. So, and this of course takes us away from the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha said that rituals don't have any inherent value. And so rituals might be useful for developing wholesome qualities, but we easily slip into this routine of performing rituals and even complacency in our beliefs. That we have this belief in karma, belief in rebirth, we have an understanding of the Four Noble Truths intellectually, the Eightfold Noble Path, we study it, we read the Buddhist texts and so on, and we become complacent because we appreciate and logically it makes sense. We keep the five precepts in the sense we keep morality in the sense of, for instance, keeping the five precepts. We request the five precepts, or we vow to keep the five precepts, and as a result we become complacent, thinking that we are moral, thinking that we are ethical. And in a sense, of course, we are. We promise to keep these rules, and then we do keep them. We refrain from killing and stealing and lying and cheating and drugs and alcohol. And to that extent, we're moral. We practice meditation. Maybe we practice sitting meditation. We have a set time every day where we do meditation. And we feel complacent because we feel good about ourselves, because every day we do a certain amount of meditation. And we feel like We feel like we're following the Buddhist path, that we have morality, we have concentration, we have wisdom. And I say that this is a sort of complacency, because it's not very scientific most of the time. Science is something that has to be exact. It has to come from cause and effect. It has to come from seeing that certain causes and gaining knowledge, ideally gaining absolute knowledge or certainty that a certain cause leads to a certain effect. Now, the problem with modern science, of course, is that it can't prove anything. And I think this is something that is often brought up by religious people to discredit science. And of course, scientists don't buy this and don't accept this criticism. But it is a bit of a valid criticism that science can't prove anything. It can only disprove things. Right? Because all it takes is one counterexample to disprove a theory. But because science relies on external the instruments and tools and observations, all it can do is point to the fact that it seems such a theory seems sound or is backed up by all the observations that we have so far. But all it would take is one other observation to discredit that theory. But of course, science says that there is no other way to know something. There's no other way to be sure. There's no better way to perform science. Now, Buddhism disagrees with this. And in Buddhism, we would say there is a better way to know and to be more certain of something. And most religions will do this, but most religions will say it's out of faith. That faith is better than science because faith is sure. Right? Many religious people will say they know God exists. They know God loves them. They know they're going to heaven when they die. They know Jesus is the only way to God. They know that Muhammad is the only way to God or so on. So they say this is a kind of knowing. Now, of course, Buddhism doesn't buy this. In the Buddhist teaching, we don't buy this sort of faith-based knowledge, because it's not true. You don't know that. You believe that. And at any given, and the reason why it's not knowledge is because at any time your faith can break, your faith can disappear, your faith can change. Faith is not an ultimate attainment. If you talk to priests, I had an opportunity to talk to a teacher of pastors in a evangelical church. He targeted me because he saw me. I had come to visit the church, and he came right up to me, and he was right away trying to convert me and so on. But as I got talking with him, I was able to ask him fairly pointed questions, just casually, not confrontational. But there were questions that he really couldn't answer. And the hardest one for him was, does your faith ever waver? And he lied to me. And I could tell he lied to me. He said it doesn't ever waver, but it was wavering when he said it. And he didn't say it doesn't waver. He said something like, for myself, I have to say. He was stalling, sort of, for myself, but I have to say that no, it doesn't. To waver means to shake, to not be certain. And so Buddhism, in Buddhism, faith might be useful, but it is not an ultimate security. It's not a refuge. Only true wisdom, true understanding is a real refuge, and Buddhism, the Buddhist theory, asserts that it is possible to be certain of something. It is possible to be sure that a certain fact is true or a certain fact is false. Or a certain fact is true. False is easy by any stretch, because all it takes is seeing it that it's thus. Or seeing that it's not thus. If you see an example that contradicts it, then you can, even in modern science, be sure that something's false. So, how is it that we come about, that we come to see things with certainty? How is it that we come to practice Buddhism scientifically, where rather than believe or follow blindly the teachings, how is it that we can practice them and know them for ourselves and be sure of what we're doing? Well, let's start with morality. The Buddhist teaching can be broken up into three parts: the practice of morality, the practice of concentration, and the practice or the attainment of wisdom. These are the three stages of the path that we should always refer back to. When we talk about the Eightfold Noble Path, what we're actually talking about is these three trainings. So in morality, our ordinary practice of morality, as I said, is keeping precepts. We have this idea that keeping morality, in Buddhist culture anyway, Westerners might be quite different, but in Buddhist culture the tradition is that by taking these vows, vowing not to do certain things, we are moral, we are ethical. And as I said, in a way it's true that we are ethical because we're not breaking these rules. But the reason we're not breaking them is because we don't have the opportunity. The real test is not that whether you can recite these vows and whether in ordinary life you can stop going out of your way to break them. The problem is when the issue arises, when the opportunity arises to break these rules, will you break them? And in many instances this can be quite difficult if our mind is not trained, if it's not true morality, true ethics. True ethics has to come from understanding. It has to be a part of, these three trainings have to go together. You can't be truly moral and ethical without an understanding of what's wrong with breaking these. And often people will say there is nothing wrong. The reason why good Buddhists break precepts is because they really don't understand what's wrong. It's not a scientific, there's not a scientific basis for their morality. It's not based on understanding. So why is it that we don't kill? Why is it that we don't steal? We have a basic understanding, an intellectual understanding of why this is wrong. Maybe we understand how it has a problem for society, or we intellectualize by thinking, well, it hurts the other person, and we have this as a premise that it's bad to hurt other people. But many philosophers have questioned, why is it bad to hurt other people? You know, if you hurt someone else, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with causing suffering for another person? Right? Because it doesn't, they say it doesn't hurt you. If it doesn't cause suffering for you, what's wrong with it? In fact, it might bring benefit to you to hurt other people. This is what they say. And of course, the saving grace for ethics is that it's not true. It's not true that you can hurt someone else, that you can intentionally cause suffering for another being and not hurt yourself. And this is a scientific fact. It's something that you can realize through introspection, through meditation. When you practice meditation, you can see what mind states arise that are as a basis for all of our actions, all of our good and bad deeds. When you hurt someone else, generally based on anger, it can often be great. It can be based on any. It can be based on anger, you hurt someone, right? It can be based on greed that you hurt someone, wanting things that are theirs or wanting to take advantage of them. And it can be based on delusion that you hurt others, conceit, based on our ego, pushing other people down, putting other people down, or jealousy and so on, not wanting others to succeed, feeling threatened by others and so on, based on our ego, based on our attachment to ourselves as being better than others, or worried that others might be better than us, or so on. So a truly unethical deed is unethical because it causes suffering for oneself. It disrupts one's concentration. Right? It's unethical because it's going to impinge upon our ability to focus our mind, which is the second training. We can never hope to gain true concentration until we have basic morality, until we have the morality to back it up. So this is how we start the Buddhist path. We don't have to start it by taking moral precepts. We don't have to promise to keep any rules. We have to sit down and look and see what is it that is causing us suffering. These moral rules are only for the purpose of restraining you until you gain this knowledge. The Buddha had the knowledge that these five things were wrong, were unbeneficial, were harmful to oneself and harmful to one's meditation practice. That killing, stealing, lying, cheating, and of course taking drugs and alcohol were a hindrance to one's mental development, to one's betterment of mind. And so he instituted these as a basic moral practice, the abstention from these five harmful modes of behavior. But our attainment of morality comes through our practice, comes through seeing this for ourselves. We take it on faith in the beginning, saying, okay, the Buddha said to keep these rules, but that's not the point or the goal, or that's not true morality, that's not our true moral practice. When we begin to practice meditation, this is the first thing that will come, is we'll start to see what is harmful and what is beneficial to us. And we'll be able to avoid those deeds by body or by speech that are harmful to ourselves, because we see that they're harmful. And this is possible because the truth is no one wants to hurt themselves. There's no one who wants to cause harm for themselves. Intrinsically, we have as our nature, the desire to bring benefit to ourselves. Something that we think is going to be a benefit, we do that. But due to our confusion, due to our lack of clarity of mind, we misunderstand what is a benefit, what is the right course of action. We often cause harm to ourselves. We cause suffering for ourselves. Once we see that these things are of no benefit, are not bringing peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering, once we see that they are a cause for our disadvantage, or that they are a cause for a disruption of harmony, they're a cause for general suffering, then we give them up. So really, the practice of morality comes simply through meditation, through meditation on reality, examining and coming to understand just the nature of our own body and mind. It's a very simple thing. We don't have to study ethical texts or doubt or wonder about what is ethical or whether ethics exists or so on. We can look inside ourselves and see what is ethical. We can know when our actions are ethical or unethical. The second training is concentration. And concentration, of course, comes from seeing what is a benefit and what is not a benefit, which is this moral, the attainment of morality. Once we start to differentiate between what is of benefit and what is of harm to ourselves, then our mind starts to calm down. Now, when we talk about concentration, of course we're talking about the mental development. And people often understand this to be, as I said, this daily sitting practice, where we have a meditation practice every day or every week or so on. Or whenever we get a chance, we'll try to sit, or we'll feel guilty because we're not sitting every day or we're not sitting on a regular basis. And it's commendable, really, to hear and to see people practicing on a daily basis. I think it's a wonderful thing. The problem is it's not enough. It's not enough to just be complacent in the fact that we are sitting every day or that we're meditating regularly. And it's not beneficial to feel guilty. It's a wrong understanding to feel like you're a bad Buddhist because you're not doing a daily meditation practice. Because, of course, guilt is this hatred or this upset towards yourself, which is really anger and hatred towards oneself, is an unwholesome state. It's unethical. It's causing suffering. So it's good to have a daily practice, but it often becomes a focus that how many minutes, how many hours are we doing every day, every week? Instead of, are we progressing? Are we developing? Are we coming to understand things clearer? Are we seeing ourselves, seeing reality for what it is? Because often people will get into this routine of sitting, and especially if you're sitting alone, it just becomes a way of relaxing. You know, you're complacent in the fact that you're going to do an hour of sitting, so you make it as comfortable as possible. You're forgetting that we're trying to attain something, we're trying to understand something, we're trying to understand ourselves deeper. And so it's easy to fall into a comfortable meditative state where you sit down and zone out or bliss out for an hour even every day, and you feel like you're a good Buddhist. You feel like you're mindful, you feel like you're concentrated, you feel like you're moral, and so on. And there's no development of mind. You're developing simply this ability to feel peaceful for some time. In a sense, covering up the problems. Because there still isn't the scientific understanding, the development of mind. True concentration, according to the Buddha's teaching, is the focus on reality. It's the concentration which sees things as they are. Not a concentration feeling calm or feeling happy, but an understanding that all things change. That the only way to be truly happy is to know that things are going to change, that everything is insubstantial. When you try to find happiness in any given object, you're only going to find suffering. You're only going to be disappointed. So even our meditation can become a hindrance to us, in the sense that it becomes a crutch, where we're always obsessing about our meditation, and when a problem arises, we have to run away and do sitting meditation, calm ourselves down again, and so on. When in fact, true meditation should allow us to see reality for what it is, so that eventually there's no difference between sitting in meditation and walking around the city or doing work or doing anything that we do. Eating is a meditation. Sleep, lying down to sleep is a meditation. Brushing your teeth is a meditation. Showering is a meditation. Talking to people is a meditation. Listening is a meditation. This is the Buddha. He said, "When you're talking, be mindful. When you're listening, be mindful. When you're eating, when you're drinking, when you're urinating or defecating." He even specified, "When you're using the toilet, when you're on the toilet, to be mindful." That it should all be meditation. That there becomes no difference in your daily life between your daily life and the meditation. And I think for most of us, this has to come through formal meditation practice. So please don't misunderstand that I'm trying to say formal meditation practice is not necessary. For most of us, it's quite necessary. And it's for sure quite beneficial. Even states of peace and calm can be quite beneficial, as long as you understand them, the benefit for what it is, and don't overestimate the attainment of peace and calm. Because true meditation is to understand things as they are. So when we sit down to meditate, we should examine even states of calm to see their true nature. And as we examine them, in the technique that I practice, as many of you are aware, we have a tool that allows us to see things clearly as they are. When you feel calm, for instance, you remind yourself that it's calm. In order to try to avoid this attachment, that this subtle complacency, you remind yourself and you focus your mind to see the calm clearly. What part of this experience is the calm? Because without doing that, you're going to think that the calm is lasting, the calm is steady, is constant, is throughout the meditation. As you focus on it, you say calm, 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 just reminding yourself and setting the mind on the calm. You'll see that actually it's coming and going. And you'll see that this is true with all of our experiences. When we listen to music, we'll say we enjoy the music. But if you look clearly at it, you're going to see that the enjoyment arises and ceases. When you eat food, we say the food is delicious and we enjoy this food. But the truth is, no, you're not always enjoying the food. Sometimes it's actually uncomfortable to be eating this delicious food. It can be, when it's in your mouth for a long time, eventually it becomes unpleasant. A good exercise with food is to try to chew every grain of rice or every bit of food to make it all liquidy or to make it all fully digested in your mouth. And if you're very persistent in this, you'll come to see that actually the eating food is not such a wonderful thing after all. And that the pleasure only arises for the first little bit, and eventually it gets quite uncomfortable to have to keep it in your mouth. Or it does for people who are addicted to the tastes. Once you let go, of course, then it's not uncomfortable. But our attachment to a certain experience, the crunching and the difference of tastes and so on, the newness of a taste, brings us pleasure. So our concentration is focusing on this, focusing on seeing the little itty bits of reality of every experience. When we say we're calm, well, ask yourself, what does that mean, and what is this state of calm? This is perfectly, completely, and ultimately scientific. We look at the experience that we think we already understand, and we look at it deeper. Just as when you look at a plant, and then you with your naked eye, and then you look at it through a microscope, it's totally different. So we think we know all these things. We think we understand ourselves and we understand reality. But until you actually set your mind on them and deliberately go over them again and again and again, you really don't understand them for what they are. So concentration is really a momentary thing. It's something that should be dynamic, something that should be focused on everything. That's the only way it can possibly become natural, and it can possibly be incorporated into our lives, and then we can say that we are concentrated, is if our concentration is based on the reality around us. It's based on our experience. This is scientific practice of concentration. The final training, the training in wisdom, is, well, this actually, wisdom comes throughout all of the path. But the final training is, what we mean by this training, wisdom, is the realization that comes from examining these things. We come to realize, of course, that certain things are good and certain things are bad. And we come to focus our minds through concentration. But wisdom is the ultimate letting go. It's the release that comes, the changing of one's mind that comes from the practice of meditation. That when you start to look at the reality around you, you look at the things that you see, the things that you hear, the smells, the tastes, the feelings, the thoughts in your mind, you come to see that there's nothing worth clinging to. You come to see that all of the objects of our desire, all of our wants, all of our goals, all of our future plans have no intrinsic meaning, have no intrinsic value or worth to them. We come to see that we're looking for happiness and peace in the wrong place. You come to see that true happiness has nothing to do with experience. It has nothing to do with what we experience. And this is really a scientific practice. As I said, oftentimes wisdom for us is this intellectual understanding of things. When we practice meditation and then we read the Buddha's teaching, well, it jives with what we've experienced, and we say, oh yes, I understand that. We hear the Buddha's teaching and we agree intellectually with it. We in a sense, we understand it, but it's an intellectual understanding. For instance, when you hear that everything is impermanent, you can think about it and think to yourself, well, yeah, that's true, you know. I mean, I was young before and now I'm older, or yesterday I felt happy and today I feel sad, or you know, this pain in my, I was feeling pain a little while ago and now it's gone. And then you can say, well, yeah, because everything is impermanent, therefore nothing can truly satisfy us. And then you say, well, yeah, that's, and then in that case it shouldn't be, we shouldn't hold on to it as ours. We shouldn't look for happiness in those things. But this isn't true wisdom. This isn't true understanding. And this is really where science fails us, because, or modern science fails us, because it's incredibly useful to have an understanding that's in line with the truth. But it's not, it isn't possible to truly understand or truly know these things. We're simply following according to observations and the tendency of observations to accord with a certain theory. And in all likelihood, this theory is based on reality. But it's only a theory in the sense that it's not knowledge in our mind. It's not certainty. And all it would take is one observation that counters that theory, for that theory to be thrown out the window. But once we, through our own experience, see things for what they are, and this doesn't mean seeing anything new in reality, it means simply seeing the basic building blocks of experience, realizing that all of experience is broken down into atomic particles or atomic experiences. Seeing is one experience and it arises and it ceases. Hearing is one experience and it arises and it ceases. Tasting, smelling, feeling, thinking, these all arise and cease. And as we focus on reality, as we watch it, analyzing and clearly seeing experience after experience after experience, we'll come to understand this. We'll come to truly understand that everything is impermanent in a way that should really shock you. In fact, if meditation is not surprising you, if it's not making you rethink the way you look at the world, and it's not upsetting your ordinary state of a way of being, then either one, you're enlightened, or two, you're not really meditating, or you haven't gained meditative realization yet. You haven't progressed to the level that attainment will arise, because that's what the wisdom is. It's incredible, really, especially once you've studied the Buddha's teaching, because you've studied and you thought you knew it all already. But it shocks you when you actually realize it on an empirical and experiential basis. Because it's like your whole universe is pulled out from underneath you. And suddenly everything that you clung to, well, not suddenly, but slowly, piece by piece, everything you cling to is taken apart. All of what you thought was I, was me, is torn to pieces. And all of the things that we thought were of benefit, were of use, were of value to us, we find are useless, are of no benefit, or of no value. Piece by piece by piece, one by one by one, until finally we, as I've said before, we're like, it's like we're flying. We become free. People always think of how dreary it must be to let go of everything, right? To be detached. This terrible thing of being detached. And it's such a terrible sounding word, no? It's a word that we always use for bad people. Oh, that person is so cold and detached, right? But that's such an erroneous perception, because the only way a bird can fly is by detaching itself from the tree, from what it clings to. And that's really what happens. Is it's not that you lose all of the objects of the sense. It's not that the bird has when the bird flies away, you say, oh no, it lost its tree. It left its tree and it can come back at any time. But a bird that is clinging to the tree will never be able to fly. And human beings that cling to this or that state are not really experiencing reality, are not really and truly free. They still have this partiality and a partial experience of reality. It's only when we let go that we're able to say that we are masters of the universe, like a bird is a master of the sky, that we have no clinging to anything, and therefore we're able to find peace, and to that we're able to be above, we're able to be in tune and in harmony with the whole of the universe and all of reality. So this is what true wisdom should bring us. It should allow us to free ourselves. It should be empirical and experiential. It shouldn't have anything to do with thinking. It is something that you should experience for yourself, realize for yourself. And this is the truth with all of the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha's teaching should be in its entirety a scientific inquiry. It should be something that we take upon ourselves for the purpose of understanding reality for ourselves, not taking anything on faith. You can believe something that the Buddha said, but that should be for the purpose of testing it out, just as you might believe a scientific theory. You don't believe it, but you take it on faith that it might be true, and then you examine it. And you test it. So our knowledge and the wisdom that comes is true understanding, and it has nothing to do with faith or with intellect or with logic. You can say that you have seen things as they are. Ultimately, you come to see that everything ceases. This is what Nibbana really means, and this is the power of it, really. That Nibbana is the cessation of all arisen things. When Nibbana is the state where everything else ceases, where there's no more seeing, no more hearing, no more smelling, no more tasting, feeling, thinking. And when you see that, you give up your attachment to all things, because you've seen that they all cease. Even for just a moment, you might see everything cease, realize this cessation. And it changes you. Because now if anyone tells you that something is permanent, you have no ability, you aren't even able to believe them, even if you wanted to. because you've seen for yourself that that's not true, that there's nothing that's permanent, that all of reality is made up of experience. You've experienced for yourself the cessation of all things. So when people tell you this exists or that exists, it's meaningless to you, because your experience or your understanding of reality is experiential, and you have experienced cessation. So you know that all of experience is impermanent, and therefore you know that all things are impermanent. So this is an explanation of how the Buddha's teaching is a scientific inquiry. And I think this is important because it then requires us to have some sort of strict guideline or framework with which to practice, that we can't simply be content with our rituals and with our beliefs, with our views, that we have to examine our own practice all the time, at all times, to be sure that we are actually investigating and examining and understanding things for ourselves, or whether we are just believing and following and intellectualizing, because these things will not bring truth, peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. So that's the talk for today. I'd like to thank you all for keeping up with me. I'm sorry if the audio broke in and out there. I can see that it's not perfect. But at any rate, the talk will be up on the website fairly soon. So thank you all for your patience, and I hope this has been a benefit. Again, I'd like to encourage everyone to please be sure to put these practices into teaching, put the Buddha's practice into teaching, to actually investigate and try to see for yourself and understand the Buddha's teaching, or understand reality for what it is, so that you all might progress in the Buddha's teaching. I hope that through your own practice, through the benefits of listening to this teaching, and through your own practice, that you're all able to progress in the Buddha's teaching and find true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. If you have any questions, I'm happy to take them now. Otherwise, thank you. Have a good day.